Hey, Brett here, and I want to tell you about our exciting new sponsor, Afterlife.com. If you're like me, you're planning to go to heaven, but you're also a little leery of all the surprises that traveling to a new place can bring, am I right? That's why you should go to Afterlife.com, the 1990s-style flash-animated website which simulates the experience of ascending to heaven after the apocalypse. Watch with delight as all the sinners you used to know burn below in a pit of hell, while you ascend into the clouds amidst beautiful animated GIFs and clip art. That's afterlife.com. So in preparation for your journey to the light, don't leave yourself in the dark. Warning, animation may cause seizures.
1 penny, 2 penny, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies make a...
nickel.
Hi, everyone. Do you like ads? Of course you don't. They're stupid. And even though School Sucks is a project that requires a lot of time and money, we're working hard to keep the show ad-free. You can help us by going to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and become a monthly subscriber. You'll get access to hundreds of hours of additional content, and it really, really helps the show. If enough people do it, it's like having sponsors.
Let's go faster!
Thank you.
1 penny, 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies make a...
nickel!
6 pennies, 7 pennies, 8 pennies, 9 pennies, 10 pennies make a...
dime!
2 dimes and a nickel make a...
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show today, September 25th. And this will be our last show for the month of September. I want to give people a chance to get caught up on downloads. We've got that Presence and Productivity series that has been completed. Anyway, what you're going to hear today was recorded live on September 11th, 2013. My co-host was Richard Grove. And this show has three parts. I want to make sure that the outline is clear so you can keep track of what happens. The show notes also might be useful if you have a way of looking at show notes while you listen. It's not mandatory. It's a suggestion, you know? All right. So the first part of this show is devoted to a discussion of the concept of inferential distance and what communication problems or obstacles are caused by inferential distance. The second part of this show focuses more on solutions and new ways of thinking, parallel thinking. We're going to be referencing a book by Edward de Bono called The Six Thinking Hats. And we'll get way into what that's all about, the tools process of parallel thinking. In the third part of the show, we're going to be talking about something called 9/11. This was very popular years ago. And we're going to actually be doing a little role play of a 9/11, what we'll call a truther, versus what I am now calling a true believer, who swallow hook, line, and sinker the government's official accounts generated by the 9/11 Commission. The coloring book people. Now, I'll stand by what I've said before about 9/11. It is not an event or an area of research to which I'm willing to devote a tremendous amount of time. I do think it is very important. Obviously, the most transformative event, perhaps, in American history, if we think about what has happened in the last 12 years. It was 9/11. I happen to be sitting across from one of the most knowledgeable people on the subject, Richard Grove, who has a fascinating personal account. We don't get too much into that during this show, but I encourage you to check out Rich's work, Project Constellation, and his old podcast, 9/11 Synchronicity, if this is a subject that piques your interest. I know I've mentioned this before, but 9/11 Synchronicity was one of the first, if not the very first podcast that I ever listened to. And what Rich presents on this subject is a very, very important historical record of what is, even though it's not something we devote a lot of time to on this show, a very, very significant historical event. But for today, I'm trying to start what I hope will become a bit of an iconoclastic tradition, critical thinking on 9/11 in America. Not very popular in the last 12 years, but you might remember last year on 9/11, we did podcast number 163. I spent 9/11 reading about critical thinking development and emotional intelligence. And so this is year two of that tradition. Look what we started. I hope it's successful. And I hope if you haven't heard that show, you'll go back and check it out. You can just go to schoolsucksproject.com and search 9/11 and you'll find it. Show really doesn't have much to do with 9/11 until the end. And the same thing is true with this show. So I think there is some fantastic new information in this presentation. There's also some stuff you might find a little bit disturbing. Also, some very strong language. You've been warned. All right, everyone. Have a good day. Here we go.
Do you think Hillary Clinton wants Barack Obama elected this November, or would she like the opportunity to run again in 2012?
I think
Maybe that she wants Barack Obama to. I think she wants Barack Obama to be elected. I mean, I don't. She does not want to wake up on Wednesday after the election and Democrats having lost this. And
if you hear the shouting, it's a group of demonstrators who've come. 9/11 was an inside job. Oh, get a life. Get a life. 9/11 was an inside job. But it was 82 degrees, 87 degrees, a high of 87 degrees in New York today. This is Dr. Ashton, Jennifer Ashton. There was also a canine dog who died in a hot car. Why is it so dangerous? Why do cars get so hot? But let me go on to our planned program.
I think the sad part about all this is that Larry Craig had to go to a public place. If it's true, if he is gay, he had to go to a public place.
The funny thing, let me go back to our scripted program. The funny thing about Southwest Airlines telling college student and part-time Hooters waitress Kyla Ebert that she couldn't fly because her outfit was too risque is that Southwest became famous promoting the idea of sexy, risque flying. So did you realize that you're going to get caught in such a controversy?
Never. I never imagined that this outfit would get me noticed for anything other than it's a very cute outfit.
I'll ponder the concepts I won't ever see.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the School Sucks Live Show. I'm Brett, and in the studio with me tonight, it's his studio, Rich.
I am here tonight.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy 9/11 to do the show. There was a new term. One of our listeners or a member of our community introduced this idea of something called inferential distance. I was unfamiliar with it when it first appeared on, I think, our Facebook page. And I want to thank Keegan for posting it. But I looked it up. It has a nice ring to it, right? So I just want to read a little definition from Less Wrong, the most concise definition I found. Inferential distance is a gap between the background knowledge and epistemology. Epistemology is the study of the origin, nature, and limits of human knowledge, of course, of a person trying to explain an idea and the background knowledge and epistemology of the person trying to understand it. Such a simple concept, huh?
It is a simple concept, and most people get a little embarrassed if you try to make that inferential distance too closely observed. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like if you point it out?
Well, if you dumb it down too far, then they're like, hey, I'm not stupid. But if you don't dumb it down enough, they're like, hey, you're talking above my head. So it's something that you have to learn how to gauge. And you can do that by asking people questions.
Right. So just to provide some examples here from the same definition. For example, explaining the evidence for the theory of evolution to a physicist would be easy. Even if the physicists didn't already know about evolution, they would understand the concepts of evidence, Occam's razor, naturalistic explanations, and the general orderly nature of the universe. Explaining the evidence for the theory of evolution to somebody without a science background would be much harder. Before even mentioning the specific evidence for evolution, one would have to explain the concept of evidence, why some kinds of evidence are more valuable than others, what does and doesn't count as evidence, and so on. This would be unlikely to work during a short conversation, which unfortunately in our private lives is all we really get a chance to have because people like to, you know, change subjects. And it's understandable. There's a lot going on in the world. There is a short inferential distance between you and the physicist. There's a long inferential distance between you and the person without any science background. Many members of the Less Wrong site.
Now, when he says you, he's talking about the people who subscribe to that webpage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Thanks. Let me just take that sentence again. Many members of Less Wrong believe that expecting short inferential distances is a classic error.
What would that look like in reality? If you had a conversation with somebody and they're using a bunch of professional jargon that is specific to their job with which you're not familiar and have no reason in your life to be familiar with it, mm-hmm. but they assume that you just know what they're talking about. without asking any questions up front to figure that out.
Well, then it kind of turns into that gobbledygook or jargon as a deliberate method of confusion. But you're saying that that's not what they're doing.
It's
they're not trying to impress or confuse. They're trying to. They really think they're making a genuine effort to communicate.
It can be both.
Yeah,
you know, it can either sit either or also and. They don't have to do it intentionally. It could be by accident, or some people are just cocky.
Yeah, sure.
They want you to know all these details or whatever.
They want you to know that they understand them. And
see?
Compare that to how you don't.
And it ties back into these other things we've learned, these other skills.
Absolutely. So, like not understanding the grammar. I mean, that's the conversations usually already begin beyond that,
sure.
Right?
You're assuming that the other person is taking the definitions as you've come to know them.
Yeah.
Without ever going through any validation process. And that's part of the communication. You assume that a message has been communicated, but really until someone gives you some sort of feedback and it's validated against, oh yeah, you know, I said, take out the garbage and the garbage is out there. You understood what I said.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't a real example.
How could you be against public education? Somebody might ask. Right. They've come to a completely different understanding.
Well, let's break down the words.
Okay. Public.
Public.
Sounds great.
Doesn't belong to me. Belongs to this universal called public. It's a collective, right?
Belongs to everybody.
Right. And then this idea of education. Education coming from educere, to lead out in the Latin,
mm-hmm.
Or to unoccult information. We don't have an education system anymore. We have a schooling system, and there are two very different things, as you've pointed out over many episodes.
But you can see that most people just accept a very surface kind of definition or understanding of what that is, and it's a real obstacle in having a meaningful conversation about the methods or the history or the intentions or the problems with the government school system. Let me just take that last paragraph again. Many members of the Less Wrong believe that expecting short inferential distances is a classic error. It is also a very difficult problem to solve, since most people will feel offended if you explicitly say that there is too great an inferential distance between you both to explain a theory properly. Some people have attempted to explain this through evolutionary psychology. In the ancestral movement, there was minimal difference in knowledge between people, and therefore no need to worry about inferential distances. And this, of course, also relates to another concept called the illusion of transparency.
Well, before we go on to the illusion of transparency,
sure.
Inferential differences or distances, you can think of it either way. This is like the gap you're trying to bridge with friends and family or colleagues that don't necessarily understand the nuances and the details of what you've taken in.
Mm-hmm.
So in trying to communicate something, you know, if you're out there and you're autodidact and you're out there consuming all this information, asking questions and learning, and then you come into communication with somebody, hey, you want to have a conversation of substance. You want to convey real information. They might not be ready for that. They might be used to just superficial, what's the score, who's winning type of stuff. And so there is a big distance or differential that you have to cover, and that starts in conversation and knowing how much you can accomplish in any given conversation. And what is the purpose? Is the purpose to get them to understand about eugenics tonight,
mm-hmm.
or just to start thinking about all this stuff we're surrounded by in a very gentle way? Mention it when the commercial comes on for the eugenics company selling you the pills or whatever is going on TV,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can start to work it in, but you also have to recognize where they are. So it's like if you're going to build a bridge, you know where you are. That's where you're trying to communicate from. But there's this chasm. And so in order to get across that chasm, you have to know where they are and be able to actually build from both directions.
Yeah. If these are people that you really care about and it's really important to you to bridge those gaps, and they're not just people that you enjoy kind of debating with,
yeah.
which I guess in both situations are possible.
Because all of this takes energy and time and consideration, and you only have so much of that, so you want to dedicate it to the people who mean something to you.
Right, right. And of course, we've talked on the show in the past about the sport of debating that some of us like to engage in or have liked to engage in the past. Maybe eventually we realize it's futility and we move on. But having these people that you really care about recognize your purpose, right? That's
sure.
a very important part of background knowledge. It's in the category of background knowledge that has to be brought into that interaction.
And that's a result of that communication. And
yeah.
you have some sort of self-reliance and self-confidence until then, but we all need from our friends and family, we need them to kind of understand why we do what we do. And that's a process that doesn't happen overnight again. If you start looking and asking questions in the world and you change your actions, it might take a lot longer to explain those actions than, you know, what it took to actually change those actions.
Right. So the illusion of transparency is simply a tendency for people to overestimate the degree to which their personal mental state is known to others.
Sure.
And I think this really happens a lot in writing. I know this has been an issue with me in the past. I write something. I perfectly understand my intentions. I wrote it. It came out of my head.
Sure.
But to somebody who's looking at that and never seeing it before and maybe not knowing me or not knowing my sense of humor,
right.
It's just lost on them.
Sure.
So these two things are related, but you introduced something to me just yesterday that I thought was a very interesting method and simple, but new. And it's like one of those things where after you hear about it, you're like, yeah, that's obvious.
Yeah.
But it helps so much to be able to define it, you know?
Once you can identify it, you can make it real and then you can use it. You can kind of, it gives you the handles so you can grab it and make it useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I would also note that the first two definitions that we lay down, that they relates to what people are going through in everyday life. And they both have to do with not understanding your audience, and that comes from not asking questions and getting to know the questions, you know, who you're addressing. It's like if Stephen Hawking, you know, came and addressed a high school graduation class, but he presented, here's his mathematical theory of black holes, I think it's going to be lost on a lot of people. But if he said, here's the struggle of an individual to persist through time and to do something relevant and meaningful, or at least try to, then it's a whole different speech. So if he doesn't understand his audience and what the motivations of the audience are, then it's really difficult to, you know, get them to do something for themselves that maybe they haven't done before.
Right.
Because you're not doing it for them. They're all doing it for themselves.
Yeah, knowing the audience is important, and I think there's also the problem of assumption, right? When you think you know your audience, like I make videos or have made videos in the past for YouTube.
Sure.
So I made this video. This is the best example I can think of off the top of my head, called Why Libertarianism is So Dangerous. And it was very clearly a satirical video. I was wearing a moose bathrobe. And no pants sitting in my backyard looking at horses, which should communicate to people.
This is not a serious man. Right.
So many people who called themselves libertarians wrote to me or commented and were extremely offended and said I was stupid. Don't you understand that you're proving what you're trying to argue against?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's why it's funny.
Yeah.
That's called satire.
Yeah. But, you know, and I don't fault them for that. I mean, you know, like how many times have I opened a YouTube video, right? And then just changed tabs and gone onto something else. And I'm giving it half my attention. Now, this is a bad habit. If a YouTube video is worth watching, it should be worthy of our, you know, 100% attention for whatever the 5 or 10 minutes it takes us to watch it. And it's not just background noise. It's not just a distraction. It's not just a way to split up now into more pieces. But I certainly understand that somebody says, oh, this looks interesting. And they press play, they change tabs, and then they go and they look at something else.
Sure.
But I thought it was pretty clearly satire. And it like, to me, thinking I know my audience, yeah, of course. Ha ha. Isn't this clever and funny?
Sure.
And thousands of people didn't get it.
Well, they're not done yet.
Sure.
They might get it later.
That's,
or you might get funnier. See, either way.
I hope so. All right. So we've introduced these two terms, inferential distance and illusion of transparency, with the goal being to, as this book we're going to get into suggests, rearranging things in our minds so we can think more simply and more effectively using our existing brain ability. Our brains already have the ability to work this way.
Sure.
But usually the way we go about trying to think about things, whether we're preparing arguments or trying to bridge gaps with other people, is everything just gets meshed together all at once, right? Where we're doing all these different types of thinking. And, you know, our brain works in different ways for different types of thinking.
Sure.
The same way you wouldn't go to a golf course with your driver and try to putt and chip with it, right?
Sure.
That's, you know, one tool for one job.
And you could. Depends on what your goal is.
You could. It could be like a talented thing, like, oh, hey, look at this guy. Like, you know, Phil Mickelson putts on his pool table. Like, oh, isn't this an interesting story? But, yeah, you could play a whole round with a driver, but you wouldn't do nearly as well if you had a bag of 13 or 14 clubs.
Different tools is what you're saying for the different jobs.
Different tools.
Environments. You know, how the ball is lying.
So using our existing thinking ability and knowing what mental tools to put forward into specific challenges.
Sure.
To help us be better thinkers, develop better understanding, and ultimately be better communicators, and maybe close some of this inferential distance.
You need tools. And when I found a new tool that I hadn't heard of, and it was similar to other tools, but it was a little bit different, I said, this might not be applicable for every situation, But when you have a situation where you kind of might need to use this tool, I thought, hey, it's a lot better than having no tool at all. And basically what it comes down to is we had studied the Trivium method, which we had talked about in previous episodes.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it at triviumeducation.com, which is administrated by Jan Irvin of Gnostic Media. You've also heard him talk about the Trivium method. This is called the Six Thinking Hats. It's by a character named Edward De Bono.
Mm.
Now, I'm going to be the first one to tell you, Eddie De Bono is a Rhodes Scholar, graduated from Oxford and Cambridge and all these other places, which is what makes it interesting. Like, this guy, he has customers such as Exxon and IBM and Shell and BP and Unilever and Prudential and General Foods and DuPont and Monsanto. All these other companies are using his method or some, you know, variant of his method to solve problems. And if those companies are doing a bunch of things that violate human volition,
mm-hmm.
then shouldn't we know and use, you know, understand at least the tools of the opposition
yeah.
and say that the tool is not good or bad. The tool is neutral. I only see people doing these nefarious things with this tool. And wouldn't it be great if individuals could also apply this tool? Because what it does is it takes away the conflict and problem solving by getting people to look at six objective layers that all sandwich themselves together when you have an unexpected situation or you have problems or challenges in the workplace or at home or these different things. So it forces you to step outside that and look at the different layers. And by, you know, evaluating the different layers together, you're no longer thinking at each other. You're thinking with each other. And he calls it lateral thinking.
Yeah. I just want to stop there for a second, too. When you mentioned that about these groups or these people in the shadows, you know, there's a lot of really brilliant people out there who are kind of the unwitting servants of this type of corruption that
sure.
you're talking about. And you have the book. I saw a lecture that he gave. I believe you've seen the lecture as well. Mm. And in the beginning, he has this metaphor of the relationship between the relationship between intelligence and thinking.
Mm.
And he compares it to a car and the car's driver. So the car has an engine, a transmission, certain tires, you know, all of these, you know, fuel injectors, spark plugs. And in all of these components of the car exists the car's potential, right? That is intelligence, IQ, potential. But thinking is the application of that, right?
It's so the
thinking
driving
is the driving,
the intelligence.
Right? So if the driver is terribly shitty, and we see so much of this in the real world, because where would people have learned the skills to be better harnessers?
They should have learned it in the education system.
Yeah.
But they call it schooling now, and it's no longer education. So
right.
Literally and figuratively. So the idea is what makes people smart is not trivia. It is results.
Yeah.
And having methods and tools at your beck and call for various situations through life becomes useful. And in addition to NVC, I would think that the six thinking hats of Edward De Bono's proposition here also add to the problem solving, because NVC allows you to, you know, use a non-obligatory language to take away all the sharp edges of a conversation, and it becomes less of an argument or a debate and more of a discussion where you discover a solution, right? But the NVC, the nonviolent communication method, doesn't give you, okay, these people are arguing and they're, you know, it's Palestinians and Israelis arguing over a wall.
Mm-hmm.
NVC might get them to the table and let them not like stab each other out of, you know, getting angry because
right.
everyone can keep their cool. But it's not going to help them solve the actual problem. Six Thinking Hats by De Bono here, breaking it down in these layers. And you can invent your own method, but this is just the one that's been popularized, and I could get a book for $3 and read about it and see his videos on YouTube. So,
yeah,
you know, take it and hack it and make it your own. But the idea is it's a problem-solving metaphor that is complementary in NVC for problem-solving and conflict resolution, but it's also complementary to the Trivium method in learning how to learn anything and problem-solving, because, you know, it's just a different way of looking at the same implicit actions to make them explicit.
Portable tools.
If that makes sense.
It's something that is applicable to all these different situations once you learn the tools and how to use them. So we mentioned school a couple times here, and we have all these past attempts at teaching better thinking, and I'm, you know, using air quotes on the words attempts, and, you know.
You could even use it on thinking, because I think most people – if you ask most people, if you just go around mm-hmm. and start asking people, what is thinking? What is the purpose of thinking? What is the form and function of thinking? If they don't know, then what they call thinking has actually been assuming, and they've been doing assumptions in their head.
Yeah.
And that's the opposite of thinking, and that's why a lot of what today is manifesting out there is manifesting.
Right.
But it doesn't have to be that way.
I think when I say attempts with air quotes, though, most of the people who have been involved with the government school since its inception in the United States 150 years ago, like a majority of those
people.
They're
really old.
were in it because they wanted to see positive results. When we talk about the true intentions of school or the dumbing down or the deliberate dumbing down, all these phrases that we've used, that's always a minority, right? So, but school has made all these incredibly futile attempts at developing better thinking in the learners. So we have the subject focus, right? Where learning is broken up into these subjects, which we could also call immersion. And if somebody is just immersed,
you could also call it operant conditioning.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, cause there's all kinds of things missing from this. Like the individual is completely left out of this process, which is why all these things, well, one of the reasons why all these things fail. Discussion.
It's the reason the system's there to leave the individual behind. It's just
exactly.
Like boot camp.
Yeah. So subject focus or operant conditioning, the immersion in a specific subject for a specific amount of time is one attempt. Discussion or the lecture format was another. Mistake avoidance is obviously a big focus in school,
if
right?
If you're afraid to make mistakes, you are impeding yourself from learning.
Yeah. So back to the car, in the lecture, he says, here's a great way to never make a mistake in the car. Leave it in the garage.
Don't
right?
use it.
And you'll have 100% mistake avoidance.
Throw the keys in the ocean.
And throw the keys in the ocean. The worst example from the government schools is repetition.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I've heard them say that over and over again.
Get people to repeat things, they will eventually learn.
Cynicism.
Yeah.
Here's a new word because I don't want to have the illusion of transparency and think you know what I'm saying without expressing myself through words. Cynicism, P-S-I-T-T-A-C-I-S-M, comes from the Latin word sitta, P-S-I-T-T-A, which means parrot. To parrot or repeat without thinking, basically in a stimulus response reaction.
Right.
So this repetition through schooling is based on a very, it's an old concept of cynicism. The Romans knew about it. They had a Latin word for it. These are things that they had recognized and identified. And they're like, you know, it bubbles up to this day. So it's still going on until we recognize it.
Right. So, we are going to shift now away from the school. And all of these failed attempts and talk about this tool's process of thinking.
Sure.
I have a couple notes that I want to just read them verbatim to make sure this is explicit before we move on. What he suggests in this encouragement of a tool's process of thinking. Which we're going to get into with the hats here in a minute. Creating some frameworks that are practiced in different situations,
mm-hmm.
which we've talked about. Having tools that are portable. Then practicing, which embeds skills and comfort
and
understanding. Okay, at that point, it's fine, but it's not repetition on writing Z's,
sure.
right? It's repetition that can be applied to a broader scale.
Right. Well, it's repetition with variation because it's trial and error. So you do most things right, a couple things wrong, and you hope to repeat it again, doing less things wrong until you can do it flawlessly,
mm-hmm.
continuously as a habit.
Right. So this again, makes these things portable and usable in different situations. So here's an example that I've used on the show
before. What makes it portable is truly that you understand it.
Right, right. So here's the example that I've used several times on the show before. I spent a lot of time as an SAT tutor. Told this story, like, I enjoy it. I think it's nice.
The SATs that they have to have. You know, tutors and go through those.
There's a necessity for this. Well, right. There's a huge necessity for this.
But there's a market for that.
In one of the very first episodes of School Sucks podcast, I was talking about this experience that I had with a student who yelled at me during, he wasn't yelling at me. He wasn't mad at me, but he yelled and he said, I've never been given any formulas for any of this stuff.
Right.
Harder math problems.
Indignation. Yeah.
Right. So I can't replicate the factory labor process that I was taught in school here, and that's very frustrating to me because his tools were not portable, right? Here's a circle problem. Here's a circle formula. Put them together.
You were doing a gravity test there, I saw.
Yeah.
It's a physics lesson, too.
Put them together, and out comes the answer.
Sure.
So the frustration of not having the flexibility of thinking to deal with a new type of problem.
Sure.
And then, you know, having to say, okay, well, what can we import into this? What's our prior knowledge? What are we being told? How can we process these things?
Mm.
And taking the skills that we talk about so often and incorporating them into this,
That was a satisfying thing that I actually realized last week. This is input processing output. This is the trivium. This exactly. is all the same thing. This is problem solving.
Right.
This is critical thinking.
Right. And it's something that we all do implicitly or innately, but what really helps is when we identify it and give words to it so we can think in terms of those words, because those words do have power within our mind, if you understand.
Mm-hmm.
So
he, in his lecture, addressed some of the problems with the typical way of communicating when everybody is not on the same page.
Sure.
Do you have anything that you would want to introduce or add here about the origins of argumentation?
Well, he refers to these characters from Greece as the Gang of Three.
I like that.
Right? The Gang of Three. And he's right. And it's Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. I like Aristotle. He's a little bit different than Socrates and Plato. No one can even verify that Socrates existed except maybe in the mind of Plato. So there's a whole interesting research into that. But his point is that by teaching argumentation and focusing on argumentation in Western culture, that we have become a very argumentative society. And it's about being right or wrong and not actually solving the problem. Now, there is a place for argumentation. There's a place for a logical, reasonable argument and structured conclusions, because that's a big part of your life, making decisions. That is necessary. But as an alternative choice, sometimes when working with other people, it's especially useful to be able to just look at everything objectively and stand outside of it and put it through the six layers of the filter. I would think of it more as a filter than different thinking hats, but everybody can make it their own when you understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, being able to have a go-to tool to learn anything for yourself is one thing, but then to be able to communicate what you've learned to other people to cross this gap, not to have illusory transparency, and all these different ideas that are that gap. These are words that describe the gap between one person communicating and another person understanding. So the more that we can understand the actual process, I mean, thinking is a process of trying to identify that which exists.
Mm-hmm.
And that which exists is what we call truth. It is something that has actually gone on in this place called reality or existence. We use words to describe everything in existence. So in attaching a few more words to this part of existence called thinking, you can then make it just as clear as looking at the things on your desk and naming what's on your desk. You can look at what's on your mind and name what's on your mind.
Yeah. And you realize, too, like, as soon as this stuff, as we lay this stuff out, people say, yes, of course. But now it also gives them the opportunity to commit it to memory and integrate it and make it useful.
Sure.
Now that it can be recalled by name instead of just some nebulous thing that's floating in the back of their minds. So just the summary of these, the Gang of Three, Socrates, he points out, De Bono points out, was really focused on what's wrong, you know? And when people would say, okay, well, if that's wrong, what's right? Supposedly, he would say, I don't care. I do what's wrong, you know? Plato came along next, and really his focus was, what is the underlying truth? And he had a variety of concoctions, you know, for how to get at what he thought that was. And, you know, Aristotle's contribution to this argumentation was, he describes it, De Bono describes it as putting things in boxes, but it really is syllogisms, the syllogistic relationship.
Well, I think when he says boxes, he's talking about the categories.
Yeah, yeah.
And Aristotle has a lot of work that is bunk. But he has some very useful work that stands the test of time because it's based on that which exists, and that, you know, that type of stuff does tend to last.
Yeah.
It's useful.
Aristotle had some bad students. Students who did bad things.
Alexander the Great.
So what De Bono is suggesting after he goes over the Gang of Three is adding design to thinking, right?
Mm.
Instead of just saying this is what – yeah, the question of what is very important.
Sure.
But to add to it the design question or the what is possible question.
Well, because that comes into problem solving, because sometimes the solution to the problem is something needs to be created that hasn't yet been created. And it goes back to your SAT problem. It's not that you're recreating the wheel or creating anything new, but it's usually a new combination of triangles and squares and circles that make up the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? To use a metaphor.
It's the question that so many people, you know, with my political background have dealt with as well. The question of who will build the roads? Well, I have no idea. I don't know how that would work, but that doesn't mean that this discussion ends here, because I don't have the answer to it.
Doesn't mean it's unsolvable.
It means that we don't have we might not have an answer, or you might not have
first
an answer
off,
yet.
The only answer you need really is who maintains the roads going forward, because there are already
they're already
roads.
There. Good
the
news.
Roads are
yeah.
already there. Yeah. Good news. So sleep well.
Maybe that one day they can be a museum to the coercive state. Like one time, folks, we were at a
before
place
before people
in our development,
had intellectual self-defense. There was a time when tyranny ruled and irrational people imposed their will on innocence.
There's also
sounds like it could be of a movie.
The dicey question of was a system like what existed in America, or what was supposed to exist in America starting in the 18th century, a necessary stepping stone in human evolution. From
I
what
think
it
so,
existed
because human beings need to be free, and you got to have a couple stepping stones between slavery and freedom.
Yeah, I would say so.
But we're sliding on a slippery slope to ignorance in this country.
Sliding back to the dark ages.
Well, get some traction.
So let's talk about
perspective.
The technique here.
GTD. Oh, you want to talk about the six hats still?
Yes, absolutely.
He hasn't even told you what the six hats are. That's my joke.
This was a long lead-in, but I think we've...
Long lead-in, but worth a listen. You want to define the colors of the hats?
Yeah. Here we go. These are the colors of the hats. This is what each one means. The first hat. And the way this would work is that you are directing your attention to one thing at a time. So this is the one hat. You can only wear one hat at a time unless you want to look like a fool, right?
Use a metaphorical problem.
Say that again?
Well, you have to have a reason to put these hats on. What's the issue?
What is the issue?
What are we trying to solve? Your website is down.
Okay.
It's been hacked.
Okay. This is very realistic.
All right. So go through the six hats of, because that one situation brings with it feelings. It brings with it potential opportunities. Brings with it some facts about, what version of website publisher you're on, WordPress or what have you, right? So once you go through that, I think it's simple enough that people can grasp it. Or if you want to use something more relative to people who don't have websites.
Well, the only reason why
your email crash.
I would balk at that is because should we be having if we go back to the ancient Greece approach where, the arrival at truth through argumentation, it seems like there's an A and a B with different positions staked out on different sides of an issue. What De Bono talks about is how instead of A arguing with B, you can get A and B thinking together in a parallel way. So when we're talking about my email going down or a website issue, I don't really see two polar opposite type positions that people would have.
Your web guy might say, you need to go with a new template, and you say, I'm really attached to this. I want to fix it.
Okay, that's realistic because that kind of happened. Okay, good job,
but
Rich.
As far as your A-B scenario, sometimes there's somebody who's irrational who's speaking that's not connected to existence. Mm-hmm. They're just saying words about stuff that are not substantial, no substance in existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so that A-B situation, there probably is a right wrong, and you can just move on with your day because that person's not going to do too well because they're not going through any methods of thinking to validate, and they're not doing it consistently, right? But when you have two people who both objectively understand what a fact is, then you even have another opportunity. They disagree. They're interested in the same subject. Great. Let's get them together. Let's figure out what this guy doesn't know, and what this guy doesn't, knows that this guy doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because there has to be growth in the direction of truth and discovery. And something is there that hasn't been widely known because one of them doesn't know it. And it's that process of discovery that should go on. Through the Gang of Three, it's really argumentation, win-lose, either or, when it could really also be also and in reality.
Mm-hmm. So that's what we're driving at here with the six hats. The first hat, and these are in no particular order. They do not have to be done in this order, whether you're trying to solve a problem or deal with a question or, mediate an argument.
It's the order from the inside of the jacket on the book.
Yeah, that's all that this is.
It's very useful. They're all right here. In fact, you don't even have to read the book. Just read this part right here. Just scan
and
that
if you
in.
If you can't read that far, I'll read them to you, and we'll go through them and we'll talk about them. The order in which they're presented here makes sense, but let's just stress they don't have to be done in a specific order because that would be awkward and kind of clunky. The first hat is white. White represents paper, things being printed out.
Objective facts and information relevant to the case.
What information is available? What information is needed? What information is missing? And how will we obtain what we need?
What do we know? What do we do not know? And what do we need to know that we don't know?
And let's just make this real and bring in maybe some of our experience with arguments that we've had about certain things in real life. There is this phenomenon that I've experienced several times and probably, you know, at different points in my life and with different issues, probably been on both sides of it a little bit, where if you know a lot about something and you're talking to somebody or you're arguing with somebody, I should say, who knows very little about that subject.
You're wasting your time.
Also,
arguments are the wrong metaphor to be conducting at that point if you want to transfer knowledge to the other person.
Sure. But what will happen, too, is that they will become agitated by the inferential distance.
That time is not when they're choosing to learn. It's like violating their volition almost.
Okay. So what you say and how you set this up is this is not a time for emotion. I know that's a hard thing to do, but like right now we're going to deal with facts. We're going to answer these questions about, you know, objective facts. What do you have? What do I have? Are there contradictions? Are we missing things that we need to go forward? So on and so forth. That's the white hat. One hat at a time. The second hat is the red hat. Red represents the heart.
Is that what it says? The heart? I thought you made those things up. I thought it was just red and it was the emotions.
Yeah, emotion is a red. Red is an emotional color.
Look, Brett's personalizing it already. He's like, white is paper, red is the heart. I don't want to spoil the rest of the list. Go ahead.
All right. So
that's good. That's
red
good
is feelings and emotions. Obviously, as we just addressed, emotions can certainly creep into our thinking. But we don't want to. Another bad habit that we have is rationalization, right? Where we start letting our emotions creep into our problem solving. Mm-hmm. And then we just tell ourselves a story that that's logic. That's us being reasonable, but it's a rationalization.
And you'll see that in your life as inconsistencies and things you don't like happening and, you know, poor results from conclusions you reached that you thought you reached. Mm. So
this takes, I think, to engage in a dialogue this way that would otherwise just fit into the argument format that we've already talked about, it takes a certain degree of sophistication and patience from whatever parties are involved, because you say, okay, now it's time for us to deal with our emotions. Now it's time to talk about how we feel about whatever hats we've worn so far.
I actually don't think it would take, I haven't conducted this experiment in reality yet, but I don't think it would take that long to convey it to, let's say, a jury. Mm-hmm. And you're, let's say you're in court and you're on a jury. I think you could reach a conclusion a lot faster by, you know, there's 12 people in there. You have to get them all on the same page and think in the same direction and break down, hey, people have an emotional attachment. Let's say the Trayvon case. Okay, you have an emotional attachment. We'll consider that in a couple minutes. But right now we're collecting the facts. Right now we're you know, we're going through here and thinking of the positives and the negatives and all these other things that are part of the six hat system. So it's the ability to stop in a situation where it is a heavy topic that has emotions and people might lose their jobs or what have you attached to it. And it's the ability to calmly and rationally and objectively assess all those areas and then weigh them and make a decision. So if you combine that with the trivia method, now you have a method for finding truth and knowing what to do when you find the truth, how to make the decision.
Well put.
How to communicate it to others.
As we go to this third hat, though, we find a challenge, a place that a lot of us might get stuck. The black.
We can't do it. We can't do it.
Judge's robe. The judge's robe. Okay. The logical negative, as De Bono calls it. The
that
evaluation.
And authority.
Caution. Risk assessment. What doesn't fit? And this is very easy to overuse, right? Just like it's the easiest thing to be is shitty in life generally, sure. You know, and negative. This is the naysaying. People often overuse this when we're talking about possibility, which is very important, or we're talking about what might happen in the future. They say, no, 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 no. Now that doesn't make any sense. This is naysaying. And obviously in decision making and evaluation of ideas, this is important. And I believe that it's overused. Go ahead.
If someone offers you whatever, a lot of telemarketing these days, if mm-hmm. you accept something but you don't know the downsides, you sign up for the security contract because they say they're going to give you free whatever if you put a sign on your yard, right? But you don't know that it's a two-year contract. It's $60 a month, and they don't tell you that, right? So you get suckered in. So if you don't know that ahead of time, then you're going to be a victim. So it all comes back to understanding the lay of the land before you take action.
Yeah, it could be the one thing that they don't tell you, or the one question that you do not ask.
or the one assumption you make. That's usually it.
Yes.
Where you're like, I thought about that. Well, did you?
Well, I mean, there's a clever psychology to that kind of sales as well, where you build people up, right? And then once they say, oh, this is so good, they kind of pass this tipping point where they don't want to believe there's anything bad. Because look at all these good things that I could soon have, you know? So people actually kind of trick themselves into avoiding some of these pertinent questions. Those are the first three. The fourth, and sort of the, I would say close to the opposite of the black hat, is the yellow hat for light, brightness, the sun. This is the logical positive, where we look for the benefits. How can something be made to work? And this is far less natural than the black hat approach.
Well, you have to consider both.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it's just positive thinking, like Barbara Ehrenreich, the bright-mindedness or bright-sidedness, mm-hmm. where you only see the light side of it. Well, okay. See how far before something
that
happens.
That doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You got to consider the entire, the whole, the macrocosm and the microcosm. So it's about balance.
Absolutely.
And so when you consider the black hat, yeah, that might not be a good 5 minutes when you guys are going through those options. So make the yellow hat turn into 15 minutes and make sure you have lots of good things coming out of it.
You know, another reason, too, why is black more popular than yellow? Because a lot of people are very resistant to
change. They can easily
think
of reasons they can't.
Right, right. So obviously, like, people would want to, if people fear change or are made uncomfortable by change, they want to devote mental energy and creativity to an explanation of why things have to stay the way that makes them comfortable, you know. So obviously black hat would be used more than yellow hat. The fifth hat is green for vegetation or growth. Do you like my colors? Don't you think colors look, as a teacher, I will say that attaching meaning to the colors.
Yeah, that's good first step.
Helps you commit.
But now you're attaching more of a picture or an avatar to it.
Yeah. I think that works.
DeBono might steal it from you.
This is where I got it. He said these things.
Oh, really? All right. Yeah. I missed that part.
I had to add a couple because he didn't say what yellow was.
Than I did.
He didn't say what yellow was. So green, the fifth hat, vegetation, your growth, creative thinking, and the alertness to possibilities. Everyone needs to make an effort to participate in this because some people will say, well, I don't do that part. Right? But possibilities. And this is really that adding the design to the thinking, not just a question of what is, which is very, very important and shouldn't be discarded. And I was almost nervous for a minute at the beginning of his presentation where he's like, well, you know, we've had all this focus on what is. But now I'm like, we're going to space, you know, we're going to.
No, he's just talking about what needs to be created. The inventive nature of America, as Gatto would talk about how, you know, in the 1800s, we had more patents than any other country in the world because there were problems and people saw that as an opportunity to solve them, to create these new things and to solve them. That happens through productivity. But when people don't have any methods at their beck and call, when they can't, you know, call upon a tool and say, oh, here's a problem that needs a creative design solution and do something and take action to make that happen, then, you know, people get lost.
Right. Right.
Systematically in this country, in this case, it's done on purpose.
843, join SSP. Nice little group here. People are chatting. Thanks for chatting.
So his purposes of creative thinking, possibilities, design, this sort of idea, that's what happens when you encounter a problem that has not yet been solved. So mm-hmm. what they used to do back yonder in the 1800s and 1700s is still the same thing we need to do today. I mean, the inventive nature is lacking in our culture, but it could return if you start trying on some of these tools for size because you'll encounter problems. You'll see that there's not a solution maybe for that problem. You can create something new and find some people to sell this new service or product. And now you're creating jobs, which is the other thing that's kind of missing in this country, the equation on how to make jobs because, you know, manufacturing, all these jobs are moving out. People don't know how to create jobs for themselves. And you do that by recognizing what is lacking around you. How could the world be better that it's not already? And you start creating something new and different. And that's how we got light bulbs and a whole bunch of other great inventions that we use every day. Eventually that all mingled into one and you could put it in your pocket called an iPhone or whatever, right? It's got light bulbs and everything, cameras, I mean, everything, TV screen. I mean, almost everything that's been invented over the past century is jammed into that one little device. So inventive nature is only there for corporations. in compartmentalization of artists and creative people because they have no other method to go and be self-reliant. And so people are being taken advantage of on a number of levels on all the corporate interactions, from the people producing and manufacturing the products in China to the people here designing software and hardware for it. You know, everyone's being taken advantage of. And then the corporations that are making all that money using these processes, they're not even paying any tax dollars. And I don't agree with taxes in the first place, but I think if somebody is supposed to be paying taxes on this planet, it should be those multinational corporations and not individuals.
Well, the word
that's a good platform. Somebody should like run for president on that, because I think everyone would be like, fuck yeah. Except the corporations, they would hate that.
Except the people who control the whole process.
People
and
love
the media.
An underdog. Sorry about that.
In the movies, you think they do, but then in real life, they seem to love Matt Ramsey and Obama. So who you can say is an underdog. But anyway, what came to my mind when I was reading, and I was really excited when I got to the green hat, because the word that came to my mind was resignation. And we've talked about this, my frustrations with people's just acceptance of really subpar customer service and products.
Just how it is, Brett.
And my crusade. Yeah. Unfortunately, what we see is that people do have multiple hats. And there is this problem of everyone trying to do all these different types of thinking together. But the hats that most people have are
black hat.
Yeah, black to some extent. You could say they have like kind of a tattered, yellowed version of the white hat.
Sure.
Where they do still have this understanding that we should at least like try to have facts.
Yeah, facts are there for something.
We should
not sure what.
No, but like.
But emotions would be how they usually lead. And then I'd say it goes red hat, black hat, then dirty white hat.
Yeah.
That's
well,
what I see a lot of.
Yeah. Or
all worn at once. And like the other hats aren't even in the wardrobe.
Yellow, sweat stained white hat, followed by a red hat, I would say, and then resigning into the black.
That would mean negativity. Well, I would say in my order, I would say emotions. They're leading with their emotions,
accepting what you're told. And mixing
up response. That's an emotion right there.
Well, no, I would say accepting what you're told and accepting authority as truth.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you do see that there is still some reliance, some recognition that facts matter. Mm. But somebody says, oh, hey, I'm look at me. I've got a news crawl bar underneath me and the spinning Fox / CNN / MSNBC logo. So I'll tell you how it is.
Sure.
Like, don't think for yourself. Let, you know, outsource
Bill
that
O'Reilly.
To me. Yeah, exactly.
He's smarter than you because he used to work on Entertainment Tonight or Inside Edition or whatever that shitty show
Ooh,
was.
Oh, he also went to Harvard. Anyway, so, the thinking is outsourced. So this is where you get the yellowed white hat.
Yeah.
This is overwhelming. This is upsetting. This is disempowering. Here's your red.
Yeah.
And the black hat is, well, I mean, Brett, you know, I agree with everything you're saying, but what could you really do?
Yeah.
You know,
it's just how it is. It's always
it's how
been
it
this
is.
Way.
So those are
people
the three.
People never get smarter.
The three shitty hats of everyday life. All right. So the sixth hat is the blue. And I would say in the actual process, this is probably where you would start and probably where you would end. So you would use this hat twice. The blue represents, Rich, what?
The fact that we have hats to wear in the first place.
The sky. An overview.
That's how you block your head from the skies up the hat.
Atop, no. The blueness of the sky. The blue of the sky.
I know. You're connecting blue to the sky. That's
right.
Brilliant,
right.
Dude.
Yeah. Over for the...
Fucking brilliant. You've wowed me now.
For the overview, right? What is the... How is the process controlled? What are the steps? The other hats deal with the components of the process, and this deals with the overall process, the decisions, the outcomes, the summaries, all of that. So you obviously want to have these things defined initially, but you want to have these things reviewed after the other hats have been worn. I even think though the tone that we're using seems like it would apply. This is very variable, but I think the tone that I've used to describe it, and this is probably from what I picked up from De Bono's lecture, is more in terms of organizational processes versus one-on-one processes. And it is, like I said, is variable to go right down to the A versus B.
Look, but
A
here's the practicality
level.
Of it. So on a personal level, use a trivium method all day, every day, and in interpersonal reactions, usually just a couple people. But if let's say you're at a town council meeting, and you're actually trying to get something done, and you see what a chaotic, unorganized group of people lead your town, and you want to go in, you want to go in there and make, you know, people pay attention and actually solve the problem. You bring in lateral thinking. You bring in these six hats. You can learn it. You can teach it to them in a couple minutes, and they're not going to have anything to say. It's not like they have a better process than Edward de Bono's Rhodes Scholar, Cambridge, Oxford education that's been bought by all these Fortune 100 companies. You're going to be walking in there with something that they have had used on them and just never recognized. So you have this as a tool. It's neutral. Just because this guy is funded by the Lord Cecil Rhodes's last will and testament, and he's out there gallivanting around the world making his money and living in Malta, doesn't mean that it's so exclusive that you can't get this book for $3 like that, like I did.
It also
and
doesn't
start
mean...
to read into it and use it and take it and make it your own, and don't just let the gangsters have all the good tools.
It also doesn't mean, folks, that Oxford University is a hatchery of pure evil. Either.
Not pure evil; it's distilled.
Right. There have been a lot of.
It's distilled
nefarious characters, for sure.
It's mixed with other ingredients of Empire.
I bet some nice people.
You have to have a lot of naive people in Empire for Empire to work. But the people that run Empire are not the naive people. They're the ones who make the king and keep him there, or queen, and so on and so forth.
So what I'm stressing here with the hats,
yeah,
I think you'd agree.
Get back to the wardrobe ideas.
Don't create a clusterfuck in your head, right?
Hmm.
I think that's a nice way. That's a nice.
That's
sound
a good word to use
for the.
My reference is Heartbreak Ridge, Clint Eastwood.
Heartbreak Ridge.
He classifies the situation as clusterfuck.
Really?
Yeah, I believe so.
That's Korea.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, the explanation that de Bono gives is that the balance of neurotransmitters in the brain is actually different for these different types of thinking, right? So when you're trying to do all at once, when you're having an emotional reaction to sure. facts that you're trying to gather that translates into resignation while you're also trying to come up with something that's technically creative to form a solution, your mind just can't – that's overwhelming for your mind.
Well,
so you don't want to think
of those
that
hats,
way.
The red hat and the black hat – could be causing you pain
mm-hmm.
because the just the thought of that problem could be firing off a pain center in your brain. So by not separating that hat out, you're really polluting the creative level, the objective level, and the other, you know, inspiring levels of the system that are going to help you find the problem. But sometimes recognizing the problem is all studying the red and the black hats to find, you know, this thing that's underlying it.
Right. Or you get stuck in white hat, right, with the question of what's missing.
Then you become one of the gangsters, the Gang of Three from Greece.
Well,
everything's just an argument, black and white.
Well, it could be that, or if
in
you're
truth,
just...
but not in communication. See, there's the rhetoric part of the trivium that has to do with how you actually communicate, build a bridge of empathy, avoid the transparency illusion, or the illusion of transparency, and these sort of ideas that create that chasm or knowledge gap in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing we should clarify, because maybe we've kind of hinted something else. In our discussion so far, the six hats are not categories of people, right? So you wouldn't, so please don't
they're layers of situations.
Right. But I think that's an important note. I don't want anyone to walk away from this conversation who might have been kind of paying attention and saying, oh man, you're such a red hat, you know? You're such a black hat.
Bono does talk about how he says, you know, so-and-so, you should wear the black hat less, or, you know, you should spend more time. I would encourage it and say you should spend more time wearing the green hat, and I wouldn't say you shouldn't wear the black hat or these other hat, red hat, or whichever the, you know, white hat too much.
Mm.
It's about a balance and recognizing that there are different levels in the filter that must be satisfied for you not to have cognitive dissonance. And Bono's work is just taking this thing that was simple, implicit, people have been doing this in some variety of ways, but not consistently. And by naming it, that's everything, because now it's a system, it's a tool, it's transferable, it's portable, it's all these things, just like these other tools, NVC, getting things done, the trivium method, tools of intellectual self-defense, learning the fallacies. These are all just different aspects, tools, plugins, however you want to see it, apps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the apps that you need to be a responsible human being, to live in integrity, to find truth, and to help create a world where people's volition is not being violated.
Mm-hmm.
Basic tools to be a responsible adult. That's how I see it.
The putting hats on people and calling people those hats is also, I think, part of the whole resignation thing, or putting people in these Aristotelian boxes where you say, oh, you're a real black hat guy. You know, or no, that's too negative. What would you say? Oh, you're the real green hat guy here. you know? So you do the green hat things. I'm not good at green hat things. And I think of just examples from my past, right? Like when I've explained, oh, here's why I like to work with Osborne, because he's good at this, this, and this, and I'm good at this, this, and this. When what you have here is a relatively simple methodology for being more comfortable in all of those hats.
You kind of have to be, too, because what you find is that in those areas, it's the person who doesn't know anything about it. Let's say you know how to do something Osborne doesn't. You guys should actually sit in on that activity together when you're going through the problem solving, because, you know, he might learn something, you might learn something, he might have the answer that's not obvious to anyone else, and he thought it was, like, you guys would have already thought of this, but here's this idea, right? Or you can have a, you know, a reverse situation where you're thinking through and you need the guy who's good at picking up the negative things so you don't have these pitfalls happen when your project kicks off or whatever. It's like the person that thinks, you know. So what you want to do is pay attention when they're listing out the things for the black hat that they're, you know, see about the project or the problem. Because if you can learn to think and identify how they're doing that, you know, and you can strengthen these other areas. So yes, you might have a proclivity to wear your emotions on your sleeve or to always lead with the facts or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's about finding balance across all those different areas, because those are all things that we perceive.
Another thing that I wanted to cover is using the hats and a couple of suggestions that he makes. The first way of two general ways was occasional. So just doing, you know, in an organization, let's say, or in some kind of problem solving pursuit with other people. Right now we need some green hat thinking. But you would have everybody wear the same hat to truly achieve parallel thinking, right? You wouldn't say, okay, Steve, you be red hat, Jeff, you be green hat, Carolyn, you do blue hat.
No, everyone wears the hat.
Everyone wears the hat, yeah, together.
Like 5 minutes or whatever, and you go around and...
Because then you're just kind of replicating...
In a half hour, you've covered all these meaningful areas with everybody at the table, and it's, you know, you at least have a place where you can make educated next steps. You might have to have another meeting, but at least everyone's gone through the preliminary thinking and they know that that meeting is meaningful enough to spend their time there.
Right. So the occasional would just be like, okay, everybody, right now we need to put the green hat on. And if you don't like this kind of, if you're the boss in some organization, maybe you could get hats made, but maybe you think this whole thing is entirely childish. So there's obviously other kinds of shorthands to describe this metaphor of the green hat. The other way that he describes is systematic, which Rich just covered, basically following an agenda, you know, hat by hat, a time limit for each hat. Everybody wears the same hat. And, you know, the typical sequence would be blue first, you set things up, you wear other hats, and then you return to blue at the end. Otherwise, it's variable. Like you might be having a disagreement with somebody, and you find that you, before anything else can be dealt with, you need to deal with that red hat.
Yep. Yep.
You know, and that's the bridge that we talk about too, I think.
And get that on the table. Put it on the table. Literally. Like write it out on the board. Literally. Whatever you need to do.
Let me see what kind of feedback or questions. Someone in the chat says 9/11 was an inside job.
That's a conclusion. What's the step-by-step reasoning how you reached it? That's what is the chasm between people we try to communicate with.
Should we try to role play that?
You can try. I don't have to role play.
Right. I have to role play. You don't.
You want to role play Al Pacino? You know.
Al Pacino's on your side about that. Trust me. Al Pacino's nobody's fool.
All right. Your motivation. You're armed with the facts over here. The official report.
Yeah.
9/11. And you see me as a crazy conspiracy theorist.
Well, I want to, for the people, before we jump into this role play, and we're gonna
lay out the ground rules,
talk about the six hats in communication and problem solving, using an issue that is quite apropos today, 9/11, and some of the feelings and beliefs about this event that took place 12 years ago. If you're totally unfamiliar, I want to just lay down some context. This is a book I'm holding. It's called Black 9/11, Money, Motive, and Technology. And it is written by Mark Gaffney. I want to go to chapter 4, and I just want to read one page so you can see if I am going to be role-playing what I'll call a 9/11 true believer, which is somebody who read this, and they said, yep. Who could possibly think anything else?
Who could have any questions after that?
They didn't read this. They did the coloring book that they made, And that's the comic book. I call it a coloring book. But here we are in Black 9/11. When you open to chapter 4, see this picture of this man sitting next to me.
I'm over here.
Sitting next to me right there. And the title of chapter 4 is Insider's Trade. Richard Grove believes that, quote, hundreds of billions in fraudulent transactions, unquote, occurred just prior to 9/11 in addition to the transfers perpetrated by Marsh. That's Marsh and McLennan, the insurance company.
If you're going
to
read it out loud, I have to correct it.
Okay.
All right. Marsh and McLennan and AIG were involved in a fraud after 9/11, which totaled provably to hundreds of billions of dollars, for which they were fined, I think, $800 million, which is not even like tax. It's not even sales tax on that scam. So he actually had printed a couple of the facts out of order.
Okay.
But they were involved in shady dealings prior to 9/11.
Next sentence. He, Richard Grove, points to the evidence for insider trading reported by the press in the first days and weeks after 9/11, when many suspected that Al-Qaeda had profited from the attacks. Grove's estimate may be off, but he is right about the evidence for informed or insider trading, which from the first appeared to be a worldwide phenomenon. The list of affected nations was long and included the U.S., Germany, Japan, France, Luxembourg, the U.K., Switzerland, and Spain. Hong Kong was also targeted. One consultant, Jonathan Weiner, told ABC, quote, "It's absolutely unprecedented to see cases of insider trading covering the entire world, from Japan to the U.S. to North America to Europe," unquote. Soon, independent investigations were underway on three continents in the belief that the paper trail would lead to the terrorists. Press statements by leading figures in the international banking community left little doubt the evidence was compelling. Ernest Welke, president of the German Deutsche Bank?
Yes, Deutsche Bank.
Okay. Was among the believers. According to the Miami Herald, quote, "A preliminary review by German regulators and bank researchers showed there were highly suspicious sales of shares in airlines and insurance companies, along with major trades in gold and oil markets before September 11th that suggest advanced knowledge of the attacks." Well, he said that his researchers came across almost irrefutable proof of insider trading, unquote. Well, he himself was blunt. Quote again, "If you look at the movements in markets before and after the attacks, it really makes your brow furrow. What we found makes us sure that people connected to the terrorists must have been trying to profit from this tragedy," unquote.
Now, there was trading on American Airlines and Marsh and McLennan in spikes that were like 100 times outside of the usual a week before 9/11. And American Airlines was hijacked, allegedly, and intersected with Marsh and McLennan on the 96th and 97th and 98th floor of World Trade Center 1. So my question was, how did the Muslim extremist terrorists do all of that? And when you follow the paper trail, it comes back to people like John Deutsch, who was ex number three at the CIA, working at Deutsche Bank's A.B. Brown office. Okay, so it goes back to Wall Street bankers, intelligence officers, Bush family members, all these sort of things that are what you can discover if you look. And it's juxtaposed to this contradictory story that, you know, Osama bin Laden led a merry band of, you know, 18 or 19 hijackers, and they pulled off what's in that book.
Personal story, obviously, for you very much. If people are unfamiliar, and I direct them either to 9/11 Synchronicity podcast, or maybe even, well, definitely start with Project Constellation, which is available at tragedyandhope.com. But, you know, enough time has passed since 9/11 where people say, where were you on that day? Where were you supposed to be on that day at the time of the first attack?
I was supposed to be on the 96th floor of World Trade Center 1 turning over some documents that I didn't work there anymore. I had been fired a couple months before, but all the people that I had worked with on the project, who I'd gotten to know and become friends with over a year and a half, they were being gotten rid of. And we thought it was just they were going to get fired, and I was turning over some information that might help them not get fired.
Mm-hmm.
But as you see that day, Marsha McLennan's headquarters is not in the World Trade Center. It's at 1066 Avenue of the Americas. So that's where they have their corporate headquarters. What's in the World Trade Center is their entire IT infrastructure. and a bunch of people who were very knowledgeable in that infrastructure. And if you're going to web enable that infrastructure and pull a fraud the size of several hundred billion dollars, you certainly would want all those prying eyes off of that system and not even around to ask questions anymore. So when you see what happens in hindsight after 9/11, and then you see the motivations and who was, you know, there's just some ruthless profiteers mm-hmm. and some people who go about satiating their wants, needs, and desires in some very sick ways. But when you get down to it, you get down to things like they wanted to rebuild the World Trade Center complex, but they didn't want to pay for actually taking it down legally.
Right.
So they turned a crisis situation into an opportunity, probably using a system just like this.
Because of the way, though, that you became embroiled in all this, and, you know, you're obviously a very smart and resourceful guy, and you were 12 years ago. And from what I've understood about your story, I think there was obviously a time in the past where you might have felt that your safety and survival depended on understanding exactly what happened that day. So you put, you know, starting shortly after your intelligence and your resources to work trying to figure it out.
For my own self-preservation, not to go make somebody else money that they could pay me a small percentage of.
Right. The reason why I mention that, not to pat you on the back, I've already done that, is to say that you have like a real dog in this fight, obviously, but also that allowed you to build a knowledge of not just the event of that day, but what happened before it and what's happened since, that obviously anybody who's even read this to cover to cover and written a nice book report about it, the inferential distance between you and that person is tremendous.
Sure.
So that's certainly a difficult gap to bridge.
But I could start to bridge the gap like this. Truth is that which exists and that which has already happened. Truth is not determined by consensus. It is determined by evidence. Everything in this book was determined by consensus, and if it was not unanimously consented to, it did not show up in this report. The truth of 9/11 is laying in the proverbial cutting room floor of where they made this report, and when you understand the mindset of the people who made this report, like Philip Zelikow, and look into his past history, it's pretty nefarious, to say the least, because he was writing about Osama bin Laden, weapons of mass destruction, World Trade Center, New Pearl Harbor, all these types of ideas published in 1998's Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs Journal of November, December. Also, co-author of the article was John Deutsch, who's in the insider trading of 9/11. So the people who did this left an evidence trail. It's not found by consensus by a bunch of people sitting around and agreeing on that truth. It's found by evidence and the repeatability of the testing of the validity of that evidence. So
You can basically see that consensus previewed also, which is, what Rich just said is one of the most important elements of understanding the story or understanding the falsehoods that were presented by the commission. And that's very important. And that, I mean, you know, if people have the time and the energy and the motivation, obviously opens up all kinds of questions that can be investigated. But it's interesting that the consensus was previewed for the American public when, where, on television, immediately after the planes hit those buildings. That official story you can see being constructed right there. Osama bin Laden.
Less than a half hour after the first explosion.
That's when the first time he's mentioned. The next day it's reinforced. They're bringing in the Peter Bergen types to really, like, here's the Al-Qaeda expert.
Peter Bergen.
Yeah, exactly. So if you don't know who Peter Bergen is, Peter Bergen is a member on the Council on Foreign Relations, which that by itself doesn't, you know,
doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't
Lots of
damn
people.
Him
Lots of
to unbelievability. But that's some background. And he was able to position himself in the mainstream media as the number one bin Laden expert in the world.
The go-to guy.
There's an interesting element, though, to his new vocation as mainstream media's number one bin Laden expert. If Osama bin Laden is not the central figure in the 9/11 terror attacks, what is the effing purpose of Peter Bergen? So, you know, when you start to think about what kind of narrative he's being encouraged to push, what kind of narrative he's encouraged to push
narrative.
By the reality of the situation.
Right.
And I mean, he might believe it. He also could be dealing with... Now, I'm not saying, well, Peter Bergen is a liar because he stands to gain from lying. Now, does he stand to gain from lying? But he also stands to gain from just having a really good internal editor running when new evidence might come into his sphere of bin Laden research. And he says, nope, 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 confirmation bias. My career depends on not looking at that stuff. Just like the same way a lot of the people that we deal with in our everyday lives, their emotions not turning into a wave pool also depend on being able to bat away that information.
Sure, so, and they would be victims of the information about Osama bin Laden if they don't know certain facts about the history. For instance, the fact that Salim bin Laden, who's Osama's brother, he's the Bush family banking manager, brokering back all the way back in 1976. So all of BCCI, Iran-Contra, Salim bin Laden, Osama's brother, is dealing with the Bush family. The Saudi bin Laden group had some small part to play in the construction of the World Trade Center in the first place back in the 70s, right? So there's all these pieces of information that are highly interesting, highly credible, that you might want to check out, because if you're trying to follow the money and who benefits and who actually did this, these are things you have to go through. But we didn't even get to the point where we started using the hats and introducing evidence or any of that sort of stuff. So I'll leave it to you. You can begin with the blue hat at your...
We haven't even dealt with the characters yet.
Yeah, deal with the characters.
Rich will be rich, right? Me. And that's the groundwork we've been laying down so far. Yes.
I don't have to remember to do
anything. He has the easier job here, even though he is the one who has to deal with all of the real information, and I'm going to be operating mostly in the realm of emotion. What I would like from the chat, if possible, is a way that if you've ever had one of these 9/11-y type conversations with somebody, and you, sir, at the very least, have a strong, healthy skepticism about the official story, do you remember how one of these conversations started? A way that... A person, a true 9/11 believer like me,
yeah,
versus Rich, if there's a way we could begin a conversation about 9/11.
You could have seen that crazy billboard downtown about World Trade Center 7.
All right. So you're a man. Now we know each other, right? You were not strangers, because like the thing that I would do if you started talking and I'm a stranger who just read this book is I'd turn around and run away.
You might see that billboard and be like, really?
So we are. Rich and I play... I really want this to be like a believable situation. What's something we do together? It's a sport. We know each other. We've known each other for a few years.
Frisbee?
We're on like a team in a league.
Baseball? Catch? Throwing it back and forth? Football? Hockey?
We're adults.
Basketball?
We play...
Badminton? Tennis?
We play tennis together.
Curling?
Okay, we play tennis together.
Racquetball?
We belong to the same tennis club.
I got tennis elbow. I don't play tennis.
We are... You're ambidextrous. Oh, no, wait. I can't make up things for you because you're really you.
Yeah, I'm not going to be acting like I play tennis because I don't.
Okay, what's something you do?
Fish. I fish.
You fish.
Do you fish?
Yeah, I fish. So here's a realistic situation. Since you're Richard Grove and I'm trying to make up who I am.
Sure.
You're down in the beach.
Why don't you just be a curmudgeon?
Where there's a lot of people who are older. Weeks go by. Somebody becomes used to you. You have a couple long conversations. They feel comfortable with you. And this is maybe your fifth or sixth conversation with them. Mm. Right. So they're committed. They're sitting on a porch.
Sure.
You're sitting together. So they are going to stay there and hear you out. What did the billboard say?
Did you know a third tower fell on 9/11?
All right. Here we go. So, Rich, you know, I was driving today. And I saw this billboard. This was interesting. It said, did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? What does that mean? What is that all about?
I don't know. Did you look it up?
No. What do you mean?
Was there some sort of useful information, like a URL or a website?
I didn't see that. I just saw the, I was paying attention to some other things. So I just saw it said a third building fell on September 11th, and I didn't know, is this some kind of a joke? I remember, you know, I actually, well, actually you know, because today is 9/11, I've got the book right here. I took it out to reread some of it. That nothing about any third tower. I don't remember seeing any of that. Look at the index.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not in the index. That's probably why they had a billboard about it. So let's use the information that you observed.
Okay.
You saw a billboard, and it had words on it.
Yeah.
Why don't you type that into like a search engine of some variety, Startpage or something else like that? It's not evil.
Okay, so third tower fell 9/11. And did you know that a third tower fell on 9/11? That's exactly what the billboard said. It's from Global Research. Should I click it, Rich?
I don't know. Do you want to learn?
Ah, I'm interested. Why have I never heard this before? Okay. It says, there's the billboard I saw. Did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? And it says rethink911.org. Rethink911.org. Now, what does that mean?
You see, once you get someone searching for themselves, it's, you know, kind of goes, I'm not even necessary in that conversation.
What does that mean, though, Rich? What do you think that means?
Did you click the other link?
Oh, there's so many links to click.
Which one did it direct you to?
Oh, listen to this. It says, the Remember Building 7 campaign is pleased to announce that we have contributed the remaining $50,000 of funds raised during the 10th anniversary towards a larger joint effort with the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth called Rethink 9/11. Never mind. I know what this is.
Have you looked at it?
No, I know it. 9/11 Truth, those are the people who think that the government did 9/11. I'm closing it.
Now, how could you know that without looking?
What? Because that's what 9/11 Truth is, isn't it?
I have no idea. I'm just sitting here on a porch thinking about, you know, breaking the tackle down and maybe going to catch a fish.
Uh-huh.
And you saw a billboard, and I'm just trying to help you through the cognitive dissonance.
Well, if it's those people, you know, I'm not going to waste my time with that.
But you've already said you haven't identified who they are or what they're saying, so you really couldn't have an informed... You're not expecting me to believe that you have an informed decision without observing the situation, do you?
Rich, they say that George Bush did 9/11.
Is that what they said? Can you show me that quote? Because I would be very surprised to learn that.
Would you like me to Google it? Because these people, you know, I can't really devote my attention to that kind of craziness. Bush did 9/11. Is it okay to Google that at your house, Rich? Okay. Bush did 9/11. Oh, see, here we go. 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Well, that's interesting. That's an interesting phrase. I've heard that before. Are you aware of what it means?
A conspiracy theory?
Yeah, it's a compound word. It's a phrase.
You know, I really just think it's a whole bunch of people, you know, with nothing to do. So they just, you know, spend their time being angry.
Really?
And, you know, disrespecting our country. You know, they're people, I think they're just people who hate the country.
That could be true. But couldn't it also be true that there's someone else disrespecting you and your country and that you haven't been made privy to that yet? So there might be something left to learn.
Well, what do you think I should do? Wait, no. That's unrealistic. That's too easy. That's too easy.
So do you want to start with the hats? Because I was just going ad hoc there, how I would handle it. You want to specifically try to use the hats?
Oh, right, because I wasn't even really... But see, do you think that some people...
It's kind of too easy because the people that have those thoughts aren't thinking for themselves, and all I'm doing is leading you to think for yourself. And once you start doing that, you're going to figure it out. It's really that easy. You just have to do it longer to figure it all out and get more detail. But, you know, once you know that you're being lied to by the government and the state and the authorities, not your friend, and that they are capable and ready and willing to do crazy shit like that, and then to fucking lie to everybody about it, I mean, come on.
So how do you think that
you just need to know that it's not the truth. And if the truth matters to you, then by all means, go and discover it. But don't be oppressing other people because you believe in something that didn't happen. You know, like Osama bin Laden controlled all that.
Right.
When the British and Americans have been funding, they created the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. They funded all of Saudi Arabia through St. John Philby and MI6 and these different intelligence groups. So there's clearly an Anglo-American establishment behind Saudi Arabia that's been driving all this Wahhabi extremism, and they use it as a proxy so that they can basically hit themselves and get continuing budget inflation.
All right. Now, before you did all that, right, there's an insert that we should do. If you had to guide somebody, right, how do you take them to a place where you can use the six hats that we talked about? If they're really still just kind of dancing around in obfuscation,
okay.
and really what is apprehension and fear coupled with, at the very least, not coupled with, because we're mixing a bunch of things together here, also informed by really the lack of effort necessary or lack of interest necessary.
Sure.
To go down what they see as a rabbit hole.
Well, the lack of interest is what drives the pseudo knowledge, because when you think you already know something, you have no interest to go see how it actually is.
Right.
We're taught in public schooling by declarative sentences. You learn through questions. So if you're full of declarative sentences of things you learned but didn't check out, that's not knowledge. That's called programming. That's how they program human resources. So in terms of the six hats, let's say you're dealing with more than one person who seems to think they know what's going on without having taken the trouble to, in, you know, reality, go through the evidence that's available and think it through clearly. So what you could do is propose that you are the person who hasn't done their homework and they're ignorant, and you would like to learn from their wisdom, because you can satiate them and, you know, you can go forward. So I would start out with whatever their primary hat seems to be at that time. If they're being emotional about it and saying, you know, firefighters, this or that, you know, or however, you know, firefighters don't deserve coverage for their health care because they weren't really first responders and the air was clean and all these other lies that the government puts out to deny people who went in and did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can now meet them on an open level field, you know, where you can play this out. So it's not so much a game as it is that this is life and they're playing a game with us already.
Right.
So you have to figure out how to gain traction and take some control and keep your perspective through that situation. So you could do that with the hats, and you can introduce this idea. We seem to be at an impasse, probably due to my ignorance. So I have this system that I use to learn things for myself. And so while you're demonstrating what you do for yourself, you're actually teaching them how to do it. So we're going to go through and everyone's going to list their emotions associated with this topic. And, you know, what good things came out of 9/11 and what bad things have come out of 9/11
mm-hmm.
and what facts do we know about 9/11? Now that's the white hat, and that's probably where people are going to get more shocked than not, because the facts they think they know aren't going to end up under the white hat because they didn't happen in actuality. And the facts that happen in actuality, oh, those are far different than what they've been told. And then they're going to go back to the red hat and say now they have emotional reactions because they've been lied to by the trusted media sources, you know, the corporate media sources.
What we've seen, too, with this, you know, the push of what has been called 9/11 truth is that a lot of people who are, you know, proselytizing this message as they see it, their emotions aren't in check either. So when they meet that resistance, they've almost developed a kind of programming for what they're supposed to do, which is like, well, do you know what building? And it's almost they've almost become a caricature.
There's responsibility on both sides.
Yeah.
9/11 truth, where they say 9/11 is an inside job, that's a conclusion. And you can't expect people to understand without the step-by-step, starting with your observation, how you reach that conclusion, because that's how we have to communicate rhetorically with other people in order to be effective. So you don't have the illusion of transparency, and you don't have this chasm of knowledge that's in between that's assumed. So you have to start with what are the actual events as they happened that are provable, that have a chain of custody on the evidence, because otherwise it's up for grabs. It could be any, you know, anyone could have touched the videotapes allegedly of the guys going through Boston Logan Airport. And when you investigate what companies control the security tapes and what the procedure was in tracking who had that evidence, it all goes to these people who are all cronies in the military industrial complex, tied back to insider trading and a long history of planning out and wanting an event like 9/11 to happen so that they could swing in with their premeditated solutions. And it's Hegelian dialectic, for lack of a better phrasing, problem, reaction, solutions, much the same as what Obama's doing right now with Syria.
Yeah.
So.
There's how that. Long would you need to be talking to this man that I'm playing before that information is provided?
It depends on how many emotional hang-ups he has.
Yeah, absolutely, it does. Yeah, I mean, and you also have to do the triage of should we get this far?
Well, you got to think out your long-term purpose, because you know some of these realizations can't be had in one conversation, but you can start in that direction. You could take a step on that journey, and one of the things I would do is I would introduce this very innocuous book called The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And I would just point them and say, look, it's, you know, it's a big book. It's intimidating sometimes when people don't read. You know, it's like, oh, it's a lot of work. Let's just read the first paragraph of the inside jacket. And if that's too long, the last sentence of that paragraph.
You can read the first paragraph. Okay, most people can take a paragraph.
A groundbreaking work of investigative journalism, The Terror Factory, inside the FBI's manufactured war on terrorism, exposes how the FBI has, under the guise of engaging in counterterrorism since 9/11, built a network of more than 15,000 informants whose primary purpose is to infiltrate Muslim communities and to create and facilitate phony terrorist plots so that the Bureau can then claim it is winning the war on terror. Now, that's not a conspiracy theory book. Like, this guy is a well-known author and journalist, and it's all respectable information. In fact, I think he goes a little bit light. Like, he shows that since 9/11, at least 14 of the 22 so-called foiled terrorist plots were shit that they set up themselves, and the other ones were the ones that the CIA set up that aren't covered in this book. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even go into 1993 World Trade Center bombing, how Imad Salem taped the FBI and his handler, the FBI agent John Antisev, and has a clear transcript that the FBI told him to put the real bomb in the World Trade Center, which killed, I think, 6 people back then. So it's proof that our tax dollars are out of control, that there are rogue forces abusing all the rights and trusted privileges that our government has, and that the evidence is not getting more scarce, it's getting more readily available, which means the tyranny is getting worse 12 years after 9/11. But it could get better. It only gets worse because we lack intellectual self-defense. So be cool. Status quo. Use tools.
James 630 had an interesting comment there that I think we should address, going back to our little role play there. He said, realistically, by now the believer would have changed the subject.
Yeah, because they have this red hat problem.
But I think your approach is interesting, and that's I don't want to call it clever because that sounds like we're trying to be manipulative. But
I would rather think
of
it as obvious, because that's how it could be and maybe should be.
It sets an example of saying,
here's what I did for myself to answer those questions.
But maybe I don't know. So tell me what you know.
Right. Speak with diffidence. That's one of the lessons that Ben Franklin lays down. Is at one point he got all these tools of learning how to learn and be a master at his craft, and he was a master in many different crafts, including masonry, chopping those ponds. But at a certain point, people decided he was an asshole, and this one dude wrote him a letter, and he's like, "Hey, dude, you're being an asshole, and when your cup is full, you can't be told anything. You can't learn anything from anyone else, which makes it a very unstimulating conversation. This sort of thing." And after that, Ben Franklin says in his autobiography that he changed his behavior because, realizing that he was distancing himself from the people he was trying most to communicate with, he was able to see those positive changes through and through and integrate them into new habits, for which he became very well known and became a great diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if you want to call it great in the overall scheme of history, given that, all the nefarious things that he's associated with. But I just try to see these people as human beings who did have flaws, and have, a lot of character flaws in some cases. But call me an optimist. Call me a green hat guy. Optimism. Is that what that is?
Yeah. Get it right? Well, green hat is what's possible.
Creative and new design ideas to solve these problems. That's what we're doing right now.
Green for growth. Like vegetables. like bitter greens. Well, I think that concludes what I wanted to cover tonight. Oh, you know what we should do just for editing purposes? We should put in just a clear explication of the benefits of the thinking hats.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Having tools gives benefits because it allows you confidence in situations, even when you don't know what the exact situation is. You're like, oh, this is a problem. I know how to solve problems. Oh, this is something new I have to learn to solve that problem. I know how to learn stuff. So it's all about being able to use your input, processing it, and output in a structured way that brings you long-term benefits over the rest of your life through knowledge, as opposed to these short-term gains that they try to give you with this disposable culture that they pawn out on people like Miley Cyrus, the virus.
Wow, you almost just covered all of them in what you just said.
I try.
Here's creating awareness that there are multiple perspectives on an issue at hand, and being allowed to say things without risk are the only two that you didn't deal with.
But you see that by putting all the hats on. That's the different perspectives. You could set the hats out in like a hexagon or whatever and walk around and physically stand in that place and put on that hat. Or you could have different colored glasses, or you could have different color lights in the room. You could have a business meeting and you got a big budget and put some disco lights in there, and it's like yellow light thinking time. Whatever. Like, I'm not saying De Bono's right, but I'm just saying he's on to something that he's made obvious. And if you're smart enough to, read a couple pages and watch a couple videos, you can make it your own, call it your own system, you know, develop it and remember it your own way, and you never need to think of De Bono again. But just recognize that before he made it obvious, it was out there and it wasn't really obvious.
So. But you see, but the way that it's explained and the way it's laid out is so brilliant, because now you can say, all right, I understand why each one of these different facets of thinking, not only different from each other, from the other facets, but essential. And then you can do the evaluation of, well, which hat do I wear too much, or which hat do I wear not enough? And, you know, the people that I'm at odds with, or are the issues that I'm unable to resolve conflicts in, what hats are the other people wearing? And it's a way to get a lot of clarity, with a minimal amount of, discovery and, you know.
And you need that, because there's entropy. Like, he came up with this book in 1985, mm-hmm. and yet it just discovered, like, we just discovered it in the last week. I saw a video. It said, critical thinking De Bono style. And I was like, this cat's interesting. Let me learn more. And then I went to the wiki, I looked him up, and I was like, he's even more interesting for different reasons. And then I continued to watch some videos. I said, can I get his book on his primary thesis of the six thinking hats and lateral thinking? It was like $3. I was like, I can afford $3. And now I got this useful tool and the videos, and I did a little bit more work. And now it's a skill that I can use for the rest of my life if it's useful, and if not, I'll forget about it. So either way, it was useful, at least in the short term. And we'll see long term if problem solving and communicating with other people, you know, in getting things worked out when you have more than one or two people, especially,
mm-hmm.
This is a useful strategy for that. And if you discover something better, great. Then you can toss this and be like, that was my training wheels. And now I got something better. But until then, I mean, being that we had no tools at all, really, given to us by public schools.
Right.
And these are essential tools that everyone should have, whether it be getting things done so you can plan your time and live a life of integrity, or having a strong philosophical foundation, or knowing how to communicate without using obligatory language, or knowing how to learn anything for yourself. I mean, these are all useful strategies that I would think would be very, you know, widely accepted and embraced if only we had the distribution method to get more people aware of them. But for the lucky few who watch this live, and the luckier couple more who listen to the podcast, you have the ability to do a couple searches and watch the YouTube right now still in this current time frame. It's not taken down yet, right?
Yep.
It's still there.
Somebody asked if I will share the unedited version of the show. I will. For you, 135. Because of the personal bond.
The personal bond.
That I feel. Oh, we have more people than ever now, and we're just getting ready to wrap up here.
Mm.
So, you know, sorry about, and new people.
It's time for after show hijinks then.
There's like, do you feel like doing more show?
Yeah, we can take a 5-minute break and then we can do silly stuff.
Okay, so if all the people will stay and chat with each other, you know, introduce yourselves. Like, enough of these, THX.
Try to explain the six hats to someone who doesn't know it through the metaphor of chat. Using only 26 characters.
Yeah. So if you've been in here, here's a fun thing. Here's a project that you can work on, right? There's at least six of you who are here the whole time. That's a hat for each one of you.
At least one of you were paying attention.
So say, hey, new people coming in who missed the first hour of the show. Here's some, hat metaphors.
Hour one summary, and Brett will put it with the video.
I will. I will.
Now you're participating in the show, which is a good first step.
Absolutely. Or while we take a 5-minute break, says after show. They're requesting the after show. That's very nice. It's
after
Nick. Thank you,
show.
Nick.
After show. You have to type more than
gracias, senor.
Make a chant.
Should we get the guitars now? So we're going to take a quick break for 5 minutes here. You all stay right there, you know? And we'll do like a high five freeze frame picture where we're kind of almost high fiving, but. Well,
should I participate or leave them hanging?
Oh,
type
my goodness.
Into the chat.
All right. Wait. Don't touch. Just go to the edge
of the frame.
Right. There we go. And we'll have some nice freeze frames of.
Wait. You can't do that because then people are going to get the Leonard Nimoy picture and they're going to say it's an ancient Kabbalistic hand sign. I'm not participating in that. So sorry.
Show me. You know, you
I was
can do it.
To do, what was Nanu Nanu? Wasn't Nanu Nanu like that?
I don't know. I usually.
Oh, Nanu Nanu was a handshake. Wasn't that like that? Anyone watch Mork and Mindy?
I just go like this. I can't do that thing. My fingers don't work that way, so I just go like,
Robin Williams.
Hi. I'm a Vulcan.
Okay. I'm taking a break.
you think?